docket of the case. As you come to the podium, if you're the appellate and you wish to reserve any of your 15 minutes for rebuttal, I will ask you to do that. For those of you who are not accustomed to arguing, if you reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, when you get to that 5 minute time, the green light will change to orange and you're actually using your rebuttal time. We won't stop you, but just be aware of that situation. And the first case we have is Dre Martina Roberts versus the County of Loudoun. Ms. Hoffman and Ms. McMullen. Sean Morgan, Deputy. You may be seated for a moment while we get our stuff. Ms. Hoffman, you are fine.
Thank you.
Up there, we can just go ahead now and proceed with the argument.
Your Honor, there would be a request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. You have your 3 minutes.
Thank you.
You may proceed when you're ready.
On behalf of Ms. Roberts, we request that this court vacate her conviction for hindering and suggest to the court that the behavior she engaged in this case simply wasn't sufficient to violate the county ordinance at issue.
Ms. Hoffman, may I ask you a sort of a preliminary
Absolutely.
Question? Is this one of those death by a thousand cuts, or is it a continuation of enough of activity that may not alone individually hinder, but collectively might add up to that?
I'd suggest to the court that even if we look at the totality of Ms. Roberts' behavior, it still doesn't rise to a level that it meets the statutory requirements. In this case, the county ordinance makes it a class one misdemeanor to resist, hinder, or obstruct a deputy in the performance of his duties. And in essence, the behavior that's at issue is Ms. Roberts' refusal to provide a government-issued identification, her telling the officers to, in essence, get out of the house, and then her, what I would call a smart response to the deputy's direction that she answer his directive to remain away from her father with a yes or no answer by saying yes or no answer. But none of those actually impeded or hindered the investigation in this case.
How many officers were present?
In total, there were three officers, although the court only heard testimony from one, and that was Deputy Van Brocklin. Deputy Van Brocklin described that he came into the home, he responded to a domestic call, separated the parties, asked Ms. Roberts for her identification. She refused to provide it. But the identifying information, her name, her date of birth, her social security number, was provided by her father. And there was no indication that the deputy had any issue about the validity of that information, that the information her father provided was incomplete, prevented him from doing something.
Did that information come before or after her dialogue with the deputy?
It's a little difficult to follow in part from the description in the transcript, but I would suggest to the court when the court goes through the entirety of that description, it becomes clear that the deputy asked Ms. Roberts for her identification. I believe the deputy's description, which is the facts as the court has to accept them, is that he first separated the two parties, he took the father into the kitchen, directed Ms. Roberts to provide the identifying information to the deputies who remained with her in the seating area out front, came back and then asked her for a state-issued identification, and at that point she had indicated to him that she wasn't going to provide it and that in fact he should leave home. He describes in the totality, he asked about five times. Ms. Roberts gives a slightly different description. And what is not in the record, and what I suggest the court cannot conclude, is that she did not provide that identification information to someone else. The testimony from the officer is that she was directed to provide that to the two other deputies. The officer was permitted to testify that information was not provided, but it was limited and not admissible for its truth. It was limited to establish why the deputy did what he next did. Ms. Roberts, in her testimony, which otherwise is undisputed in this fact, is that she did provide the information. But regardless of whether she provided the information to the deputy or not, the question comes back to, is that behavior hindering? And really it comes down to how do we interpret the word hinder? What should that mean within the context of the statute?
Do we have any legal, I know what the, and I think the dictionary definition is, and is there any, or could you find any authority in Virginia as to what Hinder might need in some similar circumstances.
I'd suggest to the court that the term Hinder has been used in other Virginia statutes before, most notably really in the map prohibition statutes, which is the basis for the Jones case, which is really one of the seminal cases about the issues of obstruction, which is that you cannot hinder or obstruct an officer investigating a violation of the prohibition laws. And so that term was used within the context of obstruction. I think when you even look at the statutory interpretation rules, which are that a word normally is to get its plain and ordinary meaning, but it is also to be known by the company it keeps. In other words, a word is to be measured within the context of the other words in which it's used. So in Virginia right now, the term hindering in state statutes appears in a variety of contexts. It appears in the statutes that prohibit annoying phone calls. And it's used in that context to annoy, harass, hinder, or delay emergency personnel. It's used in the context of destroying evidence, and in that case, it is delay, impede, obstruct, or prevent, or hinder. And so the word there has, in essence, a different context. And that's why this court has always said that when we measure the value of a word when it's not otherwise defined in the statute, in this case it's not defined anywhere else, we measure it by the words it surrounds, by the company it keeps.
But that doesn't mean that hinder becomes a synonym for obstruct in the context of this county ordinance, does it?
I would suggest to the court actually it does. And the reason is this, when we view it in the context of the words with which it keeps, the other words, because the goal is that the term should be defined consistently. And we see that actually in this court's decision in Edwards, where the court was asked to interpret the term in the burglarious tool statute. And the language was tools, implements, or outfits. And the question became whether Ms. Edwards' purse that she had emptied and brought in the store specifically to use to steal items was an outfit. And certainly one definition of the term outfit would be what clothing, apparel, something someone wears. And it's a very broad definition. And that had been the one that was adopted by the trial court and actually had been adopted by this court before. But when it addressed this in the Edwards case, the court went back and said, you know, the term outfit has to be interpreted in this statute by the words that surround it, which are tools and implements.
Well, if in the context of this ordinance we define hinder as the same as obstruct,
correct,
doesn't that make the word hinder mere surplusage?
I'd suggest to the court it doesn't. And that's the same way that when we view a term such as tools, implements, and outfits. They are slightly different, but they have to have similar contextual meaning. Otherwise, what we have is one term that seems to be an outlier to the rest. We see that in the burglarious tool statute when we define outfit. We see it in the Turner case in which the court was interpreting a gambling statute. And one of the terms was conduct. It was defined as who was the operator of a gambling establishment. One of the words was conduct. But the surrounding words were manage, finance, own, operate. And the court in defining conduct could have defined it very broadly. I mean, anybody who is involved in the operation of a gambling activity. And this court, the Supreme Court said, no, you have to define it within the meaning of the other words. In this case, finance and operate, and use the word conduct and actually define it using a lot of the same terms, to manage, to operate, and to run. It suggested to the court that hinder, even in its broadest sense, is simply not met in this case. Ms. Roberts' behavior was annoying, it was problematic, it was frustrating. But it didn't stop any of the things the deputy needed to do.
But it did slow the progress down. It delayed things.
I suggest to the court there's really not any indication that it did slow the progress down or delay it. The
counsel, didn't the officer still file, even though he didn't arrest anybody, he filed a report.
He filed a report.
Which included, I assume, the name of this lady,
yes,
her
sir.
Address and whatever.
Yes, sir.
And he got that information from
her father.
And the boyfriend was a witness. He didn't interview, the officer didn't interview.
That's correct.
Didn't interview the appellant.
There's no indication that anything that Ms. Roberts did anything to prevent the officer from doing the things he needed to do, which was to come and investigate the case. In fact, really of interest is that he describes, he went and he interviewed Mr. Roberts. He separated him, interviewed him. Ms. Roberts didn't come in and try to interfere or prevent him from talking to her. From talking to her father, to engaging in that conversation, to trying to prevent that from happening. After talking to her father, he came back and said, I can't at this point identify a predominant physical aggressor. In other words, I have no basis to make a warrantless arrest in this case.
But he could have done, could he have done that, determined who the aggressor was by interviewing the witnesses?
He could have interviewed.
Without a name?
He absolutely could have gotten that information by interviewing the witnesses. There's no indication that the physical, and really what becomes the issue is not the name, because Ms. Roberts' name was given to her by her father, and there was no indication that that caused any delay or problem.
And it was her house, wasn't it?
It was her home. There's no indication that the physical identification card, which is really what we started to go around and around about, is I want a physical identification card. Now, the Commonwealth, in its brief to this court, cited to the Layton case and said, well, but identification is an important issue in domestic violence cases. And it suggests to the court, certainly in some cases that is an issue. And the Layton case is a wonderful example of that. In that case, the victim appeared nervous and upset. The victim didn't know the name of the other individual. She simply referred to him as C. She didn't know his name. She didn't have any information about him. He wasn't somebody who lived in the home. He was a guest in the home. In this case, every indication is this is Ms. Roberts' home. She's there with her father. The police don't have any indication, and there's nothing that these activities did that prevented the officer from doing anything.
How did the officers come to be at the house?
The indication is that from her father's phone call. They were dispatched to the home in response to a potential domestic situation. And the testimony is that her father testified, in fact, that he's the one who called the police.
And the domestic altercation was between whom?
The record doesn't establish between whom the domestic was, whether it was between Ms. Roberts and her father, or Ms. Roberts and her boyfriend, or the boyfriend and the father. I would suggest to the court certainly I think you can infer from the description of the events that it was between Ms. Roberts and her father, but there is nothing specific in the record that identifies.
It was just a domestic assault going on. The officers respond to that, because we know that domestic violence can get pretty ugly. But the officers are there, and the first thing they want to know is what happened.
Correct. And there's nothing that Ms. Roberts did that prevented the officers from finding out what happened. The first thing they did was told Ms. Roberts, you stay here, took her father into the kitchen, and asked her about what happened.
Did they ever inquire as to what happened?
They inquire of him, because after that conversation, there's no description of what he tells them, because the case ultimately is being tried on this other issue. But they certainly speak to him about what happened, because when they return, their direction is, we can't identify a predominant physical aggressor. I'm telling everybody, stay away from everybody else. Everybody leave everybody alone. And that's when this other exchange happens, where Ms. Roberts is smart with the officer. He directs her to stay away. She simply doesn't respond. She doesn't say yes. She doesn't say no. She hasn't demonstrated anything in her behavior yet to indicate that she isn't going to abide by it. She's abided by his other direction, which is stay here while I talk to him. Her father hasn't indicated any concern that she is not going to abide by it or express any concern for his safety. He repeats the direction. She nods her head. The officer then repeats it again and tells her, I need a yes or no answer. And that's what Ms. Roberts says, yes or no answer. Was it the most appropriate thing to pick? Absolutely not. Did it impede the officer from doing anything he did? I would suggest to the court that it doesn't. If the court is agreeable, I'd like to see him getting close to my rebuttal time to reserve that remaining time to respond.
You may, Ms. Hoffman. Thank you.
Let me ask you a quick question. Is there anything in the record that indicates the officer didn't believe the father's identification?
Absolutely not.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. The evidence is sufficient in this case for this court to affirm the appellate's conviction for hindering Deputy Van Brocklin, given the total circumstances that Deputy Van Brocklin confronted when he responded to a domestic assault call at the residence.
Tell us what specific acts hindered the officer.
The specific acts, the totality in their summation, the failure to provide the identification in conjunction with the use of profanity at the officer and telling him to leave the residence, and then finally, ultimately, failing to acknowledge the deputy's request that the appellant remain separated from her father for the remainder of the evening. Based upon that, Deputy Van Brocklin had no assurance that he could depart the residence and that the incident wouldn't resume upon his departure, and that he could go back out and continue to carry out his duties as a Loudoun County Sheriff's Office patrol deputy.
So the hindrance was not in the investigation of the domestic situation, the hindrance was in his resumption of his routine duties?
The, That was part of the hindrance, that's right. Also, it was in terms of his investigation, in terms of attempting to identify the primary aggressor, as he's statutorily required to do, and also in the failure to acknowledge the course of action that Deputy Brian Brocklin asked that to be taken in terms of remaining separated from the appellant, remaining separated from her father, as he had determined to do based upon. Because Deputy Brian Brocklin states that he had determined that a domestic assault had occurred in his testimony. He was not able to, based upon the information he'd been furnished, he was not able to identify who the primary aggressor was at that time.
Did he need to know a name to identify the primary aggressor?
It's not clear if he needed to know the name from the record, Your Honor. However, certainly would it, certainly not having a name certainly impeded him in terms of being able to investigate this incident and gather all the necessary facts to determine.
He ultimately filed a report that included her name and address and other identifying information.
He ultimately did file a report in this incident. Whether that information came about as a result of from information at the scene or information that was gathered possibly down and booking at the adult detention center after her arrest for the hindering is not clear from the record.
At what point in this episode was she arrested?
She was arrested in this episode, Your Honor, after the failure to acknowledge Deputy Van Brocklin's request that she remain separated from her father for the remainder of the evening.
Is that in the record?
Judge, I believe it was. If I can have a moment to review the joint appendix.
You may go ahead.
No, proceed then, because I don't want to impinge on your time.
Yes, Your Honor. Hindering is not defined in the county code, but it is not synonymous with obstruct. Because otherwise, the Board of Supervisors would have no reason to include that term if they were simply synonymous.
Mr. Morgan, that we asked counsel for the appellant the question as what was the obstruction here? What was the problem that he would charge her for this?
I believe the problem was the entire totality of the circumstances and hindering Deputy Van Brocklin in terms of her failure to provide identification, in terms of failure to acknowledge the request that she remain separated, hindered him in terms of his statutory duty to try to determine a primary aggressor in a domestic violence under 19.2-81.3, and then also hindering him in his general statutory duty to preserve the peace under Virginia Code Section 15.2-704. In terms of what hinder means within the statute or within the ordinance, counsel appellant cited the Black's Law definition of hinder as obstruct or impede, and then was also discussed that the doctrine. I apologize for butchering the Latin. It's been a little while since I've used it. Nocessitur associis. The term is defined by the other terms when used in conjunction with other terms. And the county's, in its response brief, talked about other types of terms when hinder is used in a statute that accompany it, such as delay or prevent or impede or harass.
Did the appellant testify at trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what was her testimony?
My recollection of her testimony, summary of her testimony was she had denied using profanity at the officers. She also stated that he had not, he only asked her fewer times than the officer testified as to how often to provide identification.
Well, and in the point of my question, and I need as much of an answer as you can, is that the trial judge is sitting there listening to the testimony of the witnesses, not only for the information, but as a determination of their credibility, where there is a dispute as to the testimony. Was there a dispute in the testimony between what the appellant said and what the officer said?
Yes, there was, Your Honor, and Judge Kendrick specifically resolved that dispute in favor and found the officer to be more credible in terms of his finding of guilt in this case.
So we're looking to see if there's sufficient credible evidence to support the finding of guilt of Hendry based on the totality of what was presented?
That's correct, Judge. It was based upon the, in terms of Judge Kendrick's ultimate ruling, he found that Deputy Van Brocklin to be credible, he found the appellant not to be credible, and he found that a domestic dispute required to investigate, required investigation on part of the officer. He had made a similar finding in terms of denying the initial motion to strike presented by appellant about providing identification, telling the officer to leave the premises in a profane manner, and a refusal to answer questions. All of those culminated or amounted to hindering in violation of the county ordinance.
Well, cursing in itself isn't hindering the police officer, is it?
In the context of this, the cursing alone was not, but the cursing alone in conjunction with telling the officer to leave the residence, as well as the failure to provide identification, as well as the failure to acknowledge the instruction or the request that she remain separated from her father, all of those things amounted under the totality of the circumstances.
The last point, is that where you gather that she didn't follow his instructions to stay away from?
I would submit to the court that was the straw that probably broke the camel's back. Yes, sir.
No, but you said that one of the elements was that she didn't follow his instructions to stay away, which to me, I infer from that she did in fact have another confrontation with her father later on, and I don't remember that in the record.
Your Honor's recollection is correct. There was not, never reached that point because she failed to acknowledge the Deputy Van Brocklin's request that she remain separated from her father in the first place.
So what is the effect of her not acknowledging that?
The effect of that is that Deputy Van Brocklin has no assurance that the situation has been resolved and that he can go on and resume his patrol duties. He may have to stay there.
So if she said yes, how does that, I think in my duration on the bench, people tell officers all kinds of things and don't necessarily do it. So how can her saying yes assure the police officer that there won't be a subsequent confrontation?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have that situation here, Your Honor. She didn't say yes, she refused to acknowledge. So Deputy Van Brocklin was, in terms of the entire context situation at that point, was hindered at that time, by the time that, under the entire course of conduct throughout the evening.
What I think that, as we discuss this case with both counsel here, is officers face difficult situations a lot, and if people, particularly in explosive situations, and anger and emotions are high. And is the thread that you're asking this court to adopt is that if the officer says, will you tell me that you're not, that you will stay away from your father, and she remains silent, is the borderline after which, if she doesn't say anything, she's going to be charged with a misdemeanor?
I'm saying that under the specific facts of this case, because we're here on a sufficiency of the evidence case, where favorable inferences will be drawn from the evidence in favor of the Commonwealth, and the evidence is to be considered in light most favorable to the Commonwealth. And given the specific facts and circumstances of this case, when you consider the failure to acknowledge Deputy Van Brocklin's request in conjunction with the previous use of profanity and telling the officer to leave, in conjunction with the failure to provide identification, in conjunction with the entire attitude that is apparent in the transcript that the appellant exhibited towards Deputy Van Brocken throughout this proceeding. And in fact, I think when appellant testified, she talked about she didn't respond to him because she found him annoying in terms of initially her initial interaction.
Well, she wasn't the most pleasant individual during the encounter, but again, as at what point in time do we have death by a thousand cuts, a continuation of activity, as opposed to one, I don't care what you stay on, you know. This is a case that seems to me that an individual has been convicted of a misdemeanor that's arisen out of a domestic violence situation, always dangerous, as all of us are aware. But at what point in time does the activity of a person in a volatile, angry situation rise to the point where there becomes an obstruction of justice by simply saying, I'm not going to talk anymore?
Well, the county would submit that occurred in this situation after the final refusal to acknowledge the request, Judge, but that has to be considered in the context.
Well, there's a trial judge hearing this stuff, and we want to acknowledge that, and who has a much better understanding of the atmosphere that is occurring, at trial at least.
Again, in terms of the total context situation, the appellant hindered Deputy Van Brocklin in the lawful performance and discharge of his duties by the failure to provide identification in a domestic assault and battery situation, hindering him in determining the primary aggressor, which Deputy Van Brocklin has a statutory duty to do under 19.2-81.3, hindered him in taking another course of action for special circumstances as dictated by 19.2-81.3 by her failure to acknowledge his request that they remain separated, so Deputy Van Brocklin had no assurance that the situation might not recur later that evening, begin again, and hinder Deputy Van Brocklin in the exercise of his statutory duties to preserve the peace under Virginia Code Section 15.2-704. Again, through all of the same circumstances, failure to provide ID, failure to cooperate, determining primary aggressor, failure to acknowledge the request to remain apart. And all of this entire course of conduct, in addition to hindering Deputy Van Brocklin in the performance of his statutory duties under 19.2-81.3 and in his statutory duty to preserve the peace. All of those things, in addition, also prevented him from being able to resume his probings later that evening. He had to remain at that residence until he was assured that there would not be a resumption of what he already found to be a domestic assault.
Counsel, do you... is your argument that to be convicted of this ordinance, you have to do more than simply not cooperate with the police, or is not cooperating hindrance in your view?
In terms of that, it would depend on the circumstances that would amount to not cooperating. And given the specific facts of this case, not cooperating in terms of, you get into whether it's passive or active, but there was actually some active non-cooperation in terms of telling the officer to leave, in addition to her failure to acknowledge, and then when she, not just the failure to acknowledge by remaining silent, but by giving a response that was in terms of a response, yes or no answer to the ultimate request.
Mr. Morgan, its time has expired.
Thank the panel very much for your consideration of the county's arguments.
Ms. Hoffman, you have your 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Ms. Hoffman, if arresting the defendant for hindering was not the appropriate, what alternative action was available to the officer? He should have just said, oh, that's all right, you don't have to cooperate with me, continue on once I leave?
Your Honor, I'd suggest to the court that had this continued, so the officer remains, Ms. Roberts gives the answer that he gave, something as simple as perhaps requesting again whether she's going to remain apart, indicating to her father whether in light of that he would like to go and file charges or proceed in some other way, or that he's concerned for his safety. There are certainly other steps that can be taken, and in this case, and the court had asked specifically when was she arrested, and the deputy testified, it's page 30 of the appendix, what did you do after this last time when you asked you needed a verbal yes or no answer, and she responded yes or no answer, what did you do after that? I advised her she was going to be under arrest for hindering my investigation and hindering the deputy. It really is that sort of, I would suggest to the court, the smart aleck response that ultimately led to her arrest, not the fact that it prevented him from doing any of the things that he was required to do. The record reflects on page 26 that the officer went and spoke to her father first about the events, and then after that, spoke to her about what we were going to do to resolve the situation, and after that came out to speak to Ms. Roberts, and at that time asked for the identification. The Commonwealth keeps referring to the deputy's statutory obligation to identify a primary aggressor, and that's not what the statute requires. The statute actually requires that if the officer can identify a predominant physical aggressor, he may arrest them, despite the fact that a crime was committed not in his presence. The requirements are who is the first aggressor, safety of the household members, complaints, severity of injuries, whether there were other injuries inflicted, and other observations. The officer describes he came into the house, he separated the parties, and spoke to Mr. Roberts about what happened. And it is at the conclusion of that that he determined at that point that while he believed a domestic assault had occurred in some fashion, that he didn't have a predominant physical aggressor. And now he's coming out to tell the parties he wanted them to stay apart.
Do we know who made the call?
Mr. Roberts testified that he's the one who called.
The father.
The father, correct. Now, the description, although domestic violence situations can be volatile, the description is when the officers came to the home, all three parties were sitting in the house. Nobody was upset, nobody was angry, nobody had raised their voices, nothing had happened. They came in, told the parties to separate, Ms. Roberts did exactly what she was asked to do, remain in that location and allow this to continue. The fact that she disagreed with whether law enforcement should be there or whether they should be interfering with whatever had gone on before does not now make it a crime to simply want the police to not be involved in her business. And I'd suggest to the court in its totality, the behavior in this case doesn't rise to the level of criminal conduct such that hindering should be interpreted, and I'd suggest to the court it's interpreted to mean to obstruct or impede consistent with the other surrounding language.
Thank you, Ms. Hoffman.